man had two sons. Younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the share of the estate that falls to me. So he divided his wealth between them. Not many days later, the younger son gathered everything together and went on a journey to a distant country. There squandered his estate on loose living. Now when he had spent everything, a severe famine occurred in that country and he began to be impoverished. So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country and he sent him into the fields to feed swine. And he would have gladly filled his stomach with the pods that the swine were eating and no one was giving anything to him. But when he came to his senses, he said, how many of my father's hired men have more than enough bread, but I am dying here in hunger. I will get up and I will go to my father and I will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me as one of your hired men. So he got up and came to his father. While he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion for him and ran and embraced him and kissed him. And the son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to the slaves, quickly bring out the best robe and put it on him and put a ring on his hand and sandals on his feet and bring the fatted calf and kill it and let us eat and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and has come to life again. He was lost and has been found. Oddly enough, it was as I was driving around the loop of Indianapolis that I detected the first sign of trouble. If my memory is correct, it was when I was doing a meeting for the Plainfield Church several years ago. And as I'm making my way there, going around on the loop, I get a phone call from a young man that I knew. He said, do you have a minute? I want to talk to you about a question I have. Bit of backstory on this young man. He had been interning with a church, studying to be a gospel preacher. Actually, in this program, he had received an invitation to go and work with a congregation. And when all that kind of came to a head, he declined that invitation. In fact, he left his internship because he said, I really want to go to grad school and finish my education. And if I'm going to do that at any time in life, this is the time to do it. So that had been about 6 months before this conversation. And so he called and said, I have this question I want to talk to you about. He said, I was out with some friends and we were talking about drinking alcohol. And he said, now look, I'm not interested in becoming a drinker, okay? They just asked me some questions I didn't know how to answer. And so we talked about drinking alcohol a little bit, and what the Bible said about that, and whether or not that was a good idea. And that was the conversation. He hung up and I continued on. But I didn't forget the conversation. It just bugged me. It wasn't anything that he said. It wasn't anything in the tone of his voice. Something just didn't feel right about it. And it bothered me. In the months that followed, there were more phone calls. And more questions. More profound questions. What do we do with this God of the Old Testament who did these really bizarre things sometimes, like wiping out entire nations of people? What do we do with this God? And what do we do with the Bible? Can we really be sure that it is the Word of God? And then ultimately, can we really be sure that there is a God? In an astonishingly brief period of time, this young man had gone from a kid training to preach to a kid that wasn't even sure God existed. I know
That sadly, that is a familiar story. In a crowd this size, I bet there are dozens of people who have heard that story before. We are losing a disturbingly large number of our young people whose faith is being undermined. They're losing their faith. It is a common occurrence. It happens to kids all the time. But this was different. Because this was not someone else's child. This was my son. Over the last year, I've begun to share occasionally in my preaching this journey that my wife and I are making with our prodigal child. And their response has really been astonishing to me. Every time I talk about this, somebody will come up to me, if not several people, and they will say, "Let me tell you about my child." They share their story with me. And they share their grief. And so over the last 12 months, I've been processing all of this feedback. And I've discovered some things. Number one, there are a lot of hurting people among us. I've always known that in every church family I was part of, there were people who had wayward children. I just don't think I realized how many of us there are and how deeply those people are hurting. And then secondly, as I began to think back on the 3 decades that I've been preaching, I made this awful discovery that over all those years, I'd never really said anything to those people. I've never delivered a lesson designed to offer comfort or counsel or help to people with wayward children. All the times I had preached about raising kids, I had never touched this dimension of it. And then when I thought about how many lessons I'd preached about how to bring up your kids to serve the Lord, it dawned on me that I'm pouring salt in the wound every single time. I know that to some degree that is unavoidable, but it would have been nice along the way to have offered at least some comfort and consolation. And so if you will permit me tonight, what I would like to do is correct what I believe has been a glaring empty place, a neglected area in my preaching that absolutely needs to be something we're talking about among God's people today. I want to talk to you a little bit about how we process our prodigal children. Really, I have 3 things in mind that I would like to say. Like to accomplish with the lesson. First, I hope it will sensitize all of us, make us more aware of all the hurting people among us who are grieving wayward children. And then secondly, I hope I can share some things tonight that will help people who are in that position, maybe offer some consolation, maybe some counsel. In fact, if I had to be transparent with you, I'm sort of using borrowed material tonight. A couple of years ago, my good friend Mark Roberts knew what I was going through with my son. He's also a good friend to my son. And so he wrote me an email offering me some consolation. So true confession time now. I'm totally ripping him off tonight in this lesson, okay? Most of what I'm going to talk about are things he shared with me in this email. They gave me comfort. If you're processing your own prodigal tonight, I hope it will give you comfort. And then lastly, for everybody else in the crowd, if you do not have a prodigal child, I hope this lesson will be equipping for you, because we have hurting people in our church family who need to be comforted. And that's what God calls us to do for each other. And so I hope I can say some things that will help you help somebody else. That's the agenda. Let me make 4 points that I hope will help us accomplish that. Number one, I want to start with this. As you process your prodigal, would you remember that you are not alone? Let's start with that. If you are wrestling tonight with a wayward child, there are a lot of people who are making that journey with you this evening. I think I always knew that. I always knew I was preaching to church families where folks had wayward children. I don't know that I recognized how many. When I first started talking about this with my church family in Birmingham, when I finished presenting the lesson, one of the elders got up and made a comment that really resonated. He said, it's probably true that there is not a single person in the crowd who is untouched by what we're talking about tonight. It may not be your child, but it may be your brother or sister. It may be some fellow disciple that you loved and care about that fell along the way. It may be your mom and dad. But we've all been touched by prodigals, haven't we? It is not a new problem. I take some consolation in that. In fact, the truth is, prodigals are as old as Adam and Eve, right? Go back to Genesis chapter 4, and their son was murderously rebellious against their parents. But it's far from the only example. I think about Samuel. 1 Samuel chapter 8 tells us that Samuel appointed his sons to follow in his footsteps. But the sad reality is that the sons of Samuel were nothing like their father. They took bribes and they perverted justice, and I suspect along the way broke the heart of their godly father. And I think about King David. 1 Samuel 13 and 14, the Holy Spirit describes David as a man after God's own heart. In every way, David was a spiritual giant. But in the latter years of his life, his heart was broken again and again and again by the terrible behavior of his children. So if you are struggling with a wayward child tonight, would you remember that you are not alone? That in fact, throughout all of time, God's people have wrestled with this problem. And there are a lot of other people in this church family and around the country, probably far more than you realize, who were struggling with this. You know, it's not the kind of thing we run around sharing, right? I mean, your kid gets the big award at school and is recognized. We brag to everybody about that. But if he's sent to the principal office for doing some terrible thing, who posts something about that on Facebook, right? We want to talk about it. And so there are probably other people who are suffering quietly as you are, going through the ordeal of wayward children. And I would add that there are a lot of other disciples who don't share your struggle, who want to put into practice Galatians 6:2, where Paul tells us to bear one another's burdens. You know, as I've become to be more transparent about my own struggle, one of the things that has been remarkable to me is the way my brothers and sisters have rallied around me and supported me. And so if you've been keeping quiet about your wayward, maybe you shouldn't be so quiet about it. Because as that load gets too heavy to bear, I think there are a lot of brothers and sisters out there who want to help you lift. You don't have to go through this awful experience alone. Lots of other people are going through it. Lots of other people want to help. So, number one, you're not alone. Second thing I want to say to you tonight is this. It's not your fault. That was the very first thing that my friend Mark wrote in his email to me. He said, the first thing I want to say to you is, it's not your fault. And then in parentheses right after that, he wrote, whatever you just said in your mind to challenge what I said, comma, it's still not your fault. We wrestle with it, don't we? The blame game. I don't know of a parent with a prodigal who doesn't go through it. What did I do wrong? Where did I mess up along the way that has caused my child to choose this path? There are assumptions behind those questions. The assumption is that if my child stops walking with Jesus, then it must be because somewhere back there when I was bringing them up, I didn't do the right things. It is common to jump to that conclusion that if my child fell away, it must be because of some deficiency in my parenting. I've jumped to that conclusion about myself, certainly. And I'm embarrassed to admit about others too. Maybe part of this goes back to our mishandling of a text in Proverbs. Would you go back? Do you know where I'm going in Proverbs? 22, verse 6, the torment passage for every parent with a prodigal. Proverbs 22, 6. How often have we quoted this one? Train up a child in the way he should go, and even when he is old, he will not depart from it. And so we say, if you teach your kids the right things, if you raise them the right way, they will keep serving God, right? And so work it backwards. If your child does not keep serving God, then it must be because he wasn't brought up in the right way. How often have you heard that line of reason? Now, folks, there are all kinds of things wrong with that. I will confess to you, and I don't want to stir up an argument, so I'm not going to be dogmatic about this. Please don't be this way with me either. I'm not sure we even understand this verse correctly. There is some question, you know, about this whole concept of training up a child in the way that he should go. Our assumption is the way that he should go is to serve the Lord, and that may be the correct way to see this, but it is not the only way people see this verse. The way that he could go, some believes, means that you raise your children in a way that fits their abilities and their talents and their gifts. To illustrate, if your kid is not good with numbers, don't push him to be an accountant because that's what daddy did. Train him in the way that he should go according to his bend. You need to know that that's another perfectly legitimate way to interpret this text and certainly a correct principle. But for the sake of argument, let's assume that our traditional way of viewing this text is correct. That it means training up your kids to serve the Lord. Remember, it's a proverb. And it speaks of things that are generally true, but not always absolutely true. And maybe you're thinking, that's pretty self-serving for a parent of a prodigal. And perhaps it is. But folks, we certainly understand that with other proverbs. Can I illustrate that? I'm stuck with Proverbs chapter 10 and verse 27, which I think makes the principle we're trying to make obvious. Proverbs 10:27 says, "The fear of the Lord prolongs life, but the years of the wicked will be shortened." Is that principle generally true? I think it is. If you live a righteous life, you are likely to live longer. You will certainly avoid some of the sinful pitfalls that could cut your life short. And if you are a wicked person and do evil things, you may well get caught up in something like drug and alcohol abuse that could cut your life short, right? So generally speaking, this is true. Is it absolutely true? Does that mean no good people ever die young? Does that mean no bad people ever live to an old age? If that's true, please explain Hugh Hefner to me. Why is he still alive? You see the point? Proverbs speak of things that are generally true, not absolutely true, all the time, in every case. Now let me confess that I think just correcting our misunderstanding of Proverbs 22:6 probably doesn't do a whole lot to allay those feelings of guilt and responsibility that parents with prodigals have. We just feel like if our kids fell away, and somewhere back there we must surely have done something wrong. May I suggest to you that the problem with that is that it is never that simple. When we start asking the question why, we must appreciate that the answers to that are typically very complicated and multifaceted. There's a lot that has to be considered. And let's start with parents, because parents certainly do matter in the process of bringing up children. Again, I'm in Proverbs. Look at Proverbs 29. I'm in Proverbs 29. Look it down at verse 15. Proverbs 29:15, the rod and reproof give wisdom, but a child who gets his own way brings shame to his mother. I believe that's true. I've seen that. Parents who were unduly indulgent with their children, did not correct their bad behavior, and when those kids got grown up, man, they caused a lot of grief and misery for mom and dad, and they bore some responsibility for how things worked out with this kid. Let me be crystal clear. Parents do matter. And so Proverbs 29:17, correct your son and he will give you comfort. He will also delight your soul. Backing up to Proverbs 19 this time. Proverbs 19 and verse 18. Discipline your son while there is hope and do not desire his death. Ephesians 6:4. Bring up your children in the discipline and instruction of the Lord, Paul said. I want to be clear that mom and dad matter in the process. We get our kids first and we get their respect and we get to help them lay that spiritual foundation on which a godly life is going to be built. But let me give you a second reality. No one does that perfectly. Isn't it interesting that God gives children to parents, at least initially, who have absolutely no experience with children? We sort of grow up together. And as a consequence of that, just like our kids mess up along the way, so do we. In fact, even parents with kids who turned out in just the way we wanted them to, even parents whose kids are faithfully serving God, made mistakes along the way. What parent in this crowd is going to raise their hand and say, no, I executed parenting perfectly. Made no mistakes while my kids were growing up. Who would say that? And if someone did, who would believe it? Parents with prodigals wrestle with their failures and wonder what we did wrong that caused or contributed to our kids' struggle. The truth is, every parent messes up. In fact, if I could add a third complicating factor to this, have you noticed how parenting and outcome do not always line up? Again, it sounds self-serving, but we all know it's true. You've seen a mom and dad who, from all appearances, were doing all the right things, great parents, and maybe they had three children, and with two of them, the outcome was just what you expected. Those kids grew up and they were faithful and they served the Lord, and then there was that third one, who from the time he was old enough to exercise his own will, resisted and rebelled, and when he got grown up, he couldn't be any different than the other two. How does that happen? I've got a son who struggles with belief in God, and a son who every Sunday preaches the gospel. How does that happen? And it happens in reverse too, have you noticed this? I've seen some mom and dads who just overtly did not do what the Bible said. I mean, you could look at their lives and know, when you compare it to the Bible standard, they are not good parents. And they had children, and you could see the impact of that on their children. And yet they had this one who, in spite of everything that was wrong at home, tenaciously held on to God and served God. How does that happen? How did Josiah wind up being such a great king and a great servant of God when his father and grandfather were so terribly wicked? You see, we know it's true. Parenting and outcome do not always line up. And then we could throw this factor into the mix. I'm not going to be the only person who influences my children. So I'm in Proverbs 1 now, if you will look there. Proverbs chapter 1. Look at verse 8 first. This is Proverbs 1, verse 8. Hear, my son, your father's instruction, and do not forsake your mother's teaching. Indeed, they are a graceful wreath to your head and ornaments about your neck. So let's pause there. We have a father and mother who've done their job. Right, are you with me? They have taught their child, because the instruction is, listen to what your daddy said and listen to what your mother taught you. They're going to bless you if you'll pay attention to that. So in verses 8 and 9, mom and dad have done their job. But look at the warning in verse 10. My son, if sinners entice you, do not consent. So here's this child that has been raised right, heard the right instruction, and yet Solomon is warning there's a danger that he might listen to another voice, in spite of what mom and dad have said, that he would hear somebody else. Maybe a crowd of friends at school. Maybe a spouse. Maybe a teacher who calls them and lures them down a different path. They will hear another voice. And maybe they'll choose to listen to that voice. What are we trying to say? It's not just one thing. Parents for prodigals are always looking for that single cause. And the truth is, it is rarely that simple. Lots of things serve to undermine someone's faith. And ultimately, we have to decide how we're going to respond to those things. I think that's what my friend was trying to tell me when he said, it's not your fault. Ultimately, each of us decides about God. 2 Corinthians 5 in verse 10, Paul said that we all have to appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that each one can be recompensed for the deeds done in the body, whether good or evil. I answer to God for what I've done. I will not be able to go before God on judgment day and say, listen, I didn't serve you because I listened to my friends. It's not my fault. Or I listened to my college professor. It's not my fault. Or listen, I didn't serve you because my mom and dad didn't pray with me enough and we didn't have enough home Bible study. I gotta tell you what, whatever my parents did or did not do in encouraging me or not encouraging me to serve God, at the end of the day, I make my choice about that. I asked the question a minute ago. How is it that Josiah, remember that 8-year-old boy rather, that became king? How did that 8-year-old boy wind up being a great spiritual leader for a nation when he came from such a wicked background? The answer is in 2 Chronicles 34, verse 3. For in the 8th year of his reign, while he was still a youth, he began to seek the God of his father David. He chose to seek the Lord. And that's what we all do. So, two parents of wayward children. If you feel like along the way as a parent, you messed up. Maybe you didn't do enough study with your children. Maybe you didn't emphasize the right things enough. Maybe you were too caught up in the world in their growing up years. And you feel like you weren't the example you could be. Fine, own that. Apologize to them. But then remember, at the end of the day, while we may impact our children's spiritual future, we do not determine. Everyone decides for themselves whether or not they will serve God. I'm going to tell you, brothers and sisters, if I do not go to heaven, it will not be my parents' fault. It will be my fault. And if that's true for me, then I have to acknowledge it's true for my son too. In that sense, it's not your fault. Third thing I'd like to say tonight is this. Don't ever give up. That was the third thing my friend wrote in his email. And don't tell him I said this, but frankly, I was a little irritated when I read that. What do you mean? Don't give up. This is my kid. I would never give up. That email came early in the journey. And little did I know about the dark and difficult and frustrating days that were going to be ahead for us. And I must confess that there have been some times along this road where I was so frustrated and felt so powerless to bring about the changes I wanted to see in my son that I was ready to quit. I looked at my wife, I said, let's sell everything, let's hire on and go work on a sailboat or something. We have those moments where we're ready to give up. And so I needed to hear that. Let me say a few things to you about not giving up. First of all, when I say don't give up, I do not mean constantly force the issue with your kid. I definitely don't mean that, okay? I've taken a lot of comfort and counsel from Colossians chapter 4. So I want to point you to this text. I use this text all the time in talking to people about evangelism. I just think for a long time I failed to see how helpful it is as I try to process my prodigal child. So Colossians 4, look down at verse 2. Paul says, devote yourselves to prayer, keeping alert in it with an attitude of thanksgiving. praying at the same time for us as well, that God will open up to us a door for the word so that we may speak forth the mystery of Christ for which I have been imprisoned, that I may make it clear in the way that I ought to speak. Conduct yourself with wisdom toward outsiders, making the most of the opportunity. Let your speech always be with grace, as though seasoned with salt, so you will know how you should respond to each person. And so I've started thinking about this text a lot as I've worked with my son over the last couple of years. Notice that Paul urges us to act with wisdom as we interact with lost people. And listen, I've taught that to people working with the lost a lot. I've told people, listen, when folks aren't open, don't force the issue, right? You got a coworker and you're trying to talk to them about Jesus and they don't want to hear it, don't keep pressing. They're not open to hear it right now. And if you keep pressing, you may close a door that will open later on. Candidly, it's a lot easier to do that with a coworker than with my kid. But it's still true. Working with prodigals means being wise and knowing when to say something and knowing what to say and knowing when not to say anything at all. Trust me. I know that that is easier said than done. And so I would add secondly, just because we're not saying anything doesn't mean we're not doing anything. So there's a lot of stuff in this text that doesn't require us saying anything to our kids at all. Paul mentions, for example, did you notice the prayers for open doors in verse number 3? So I pray that about my kids. That God will give me opportunities to be able to talk to him about his spiritual situation. And so while I'm waiting for the doors, the other thing that I do is I pray that I will handle them wisely. And so verse 5 and 6, conduct yourself with wisdom. Make the most of the opportunities. Let your speech always be with grace as though seasoned with salt. I've got the sub-processor that works in my mind that imagines that time when the door's going to open up and he's going to let me talk. And my thought is, what am I going to say? What's the right subject? How is it best expressed? You see, even if we aren't saying anything at all, we're still thinking and working, considering how we will reach them. I know that's hard, easy to say and hard to do. I tell you what I want to do. I want to get my son, sit him down, have a 2-hour conversation across the kitchen table and fix this. It just doesn't always work that way. Recently, he has started coming back to worship service. A little. And he had promised me that a week ago Sunday, he was going to come. He didn't come in the morning. And frankly, on Sunday afternoon, we were helping him move. And an hour before services, he is a sweaty mess up in my attic. And you know what I'm thinking about, right? Not where he's putting stuff in my attic as much as I'm kind of hung up about that kind of stuff. It does need to be correctly organized in the attic after all. I'm thinking, it's 4 o'clock, we start at 5, he still has to go home and shower, he's not coming. And I really wanted to say something about that. And I thought, he's 27 years old. Me needling him and pushing him isn't going to fix this. He's going to come, he's going to come. And as hard as it was, I kept my mouth shut. And he showed up. I'm thankful for the small victories. Remember that as long as we are still here and they are still here and the Lord hasn't come, there's always an opportunity to bring them back. We don't ever give up. But I will say this. This is the last thing I want to say to you. And the hardest thing. We do need to be willing to go on without them. When I brought my children into the world, my wife and I really defined a single vision and desire for them. I've vocalized that in teaching over and over again. Whatever does or does not happen with my kids, I will tell you what matters to me is that when the trumpet sounds and the Lord comes, that they go to be with Him in the end. Going to heaven was the agenda. It continues to be the agenda with our children. But what I have been forced to accept now that both of my boys are adult men is that they may not choose to go, that they may choose another path. I will tell you that all of us along the way, if we make this journey very far as a disciple, all of us are going to experience this with somebody. If it is not your child or your spouse, it will be someone in your spiritual family, someone that at one point was walking with Jesus with you and decided to stop doing that. And when that happens, we can do everything, like I'm doing with my son, to try to persuade them to come back and show them the error of their ways and the awful consequences. And we can plead and we can appeal, and maybe some will be won back and maybe some will not. But I will tell you what, folks. I remember at one particularly difficult moment sitting down with my wife in the kitchen and saying, look, whatever happens with these kids, we've got to go, whether anybody else does or not. We've got to go to heaven. I cannot allow what happens with others, not fellow disciples, not my family, not my kids, not my spouse, nothing, brothers and sisters, to deter us from the goal. Even if my kids don't go, if my wife decides that she's not going to go, I'm still going to heaven. Because in the end, there's just nothing more important than being found in Him. So no matter who drops off, changes path, backs out, quits walking with Jesus, we've got to go on. Let's get ready to sing the invitation song. Thank you for your attention tonight. I will tell you why I say that to you. Because this life we live, brothers and sisters, is just for a moment. And what we are doing is we are in the prelude stage of the main act, and that is heaven with God when all of this is over. And whatever happens in this life, good or bad, it doesn't begin to compare, Paul will tell us, with the glory that is coming when all of this is over. Nothing in this life is worth missing that. Whatever anybody else does, I'm going on. I'm going to heaven. It needs to be your choice too. So if you're looking at your life tonight and you're saying, that's not my destination, I know things are not square with me and God, and if He came tonight, I would not be going. I don't care what else is going on with you, what your bills look like, what's wrong in your marriage, maybe you got fired from your job today. If you're not going to heaven, that is your problem, and that needs to be fixed right now. We want to help you do that. God's like that daddy in the story. He's watching the road tonight. He's waiting for you to come home. He's been waiting a long time. Don't disappoint Him. You need to come home. Do it right now. Make your way to the front while we stand, while we sing.